you cannot learn or do a program like coding and robotics in a classroom that doesn't have a ceiling, that doesn't have glass in its windows.
There's a transfer of skills, there's a transfer of knowledge almost from the corporate private sector to help the charity or the organization almost function more like a business. Let's just upgrade how we do things around here.
If corporates want to get involved in a community and also for the corporate to understand and make sense of the proposal that your NPC puts forward, go to the community on your own with a staff member from the community. I don't care how you get there, but immerse yourself into that community.
You're at the right place. My guest today is not just a founder or a consultant. He is a bridge builder between the boardroom and the rural classroom, between corporate intent and community reality. Felix Spiss is the founder of Siyafunda Education Foundation. They focus on empowering learners with iSTEM education throughout South Africa. He is also an expert guide in the impact sector, where he specializes in strategic partnerships, locking philanthropy, and ensuring sustainability, and turning it from charity into a sustainable economic force. Welcome, Felix. Wonderful to talk to you today.
Thanks so much, John. Happy to be here at the right place.
Awesome, Felix. Let's dive straight in. You're leading school infrastructure upgrades in rural areas, predominantly the Northern Cape. Beyond the buildings, what kind of transformation are you actually building?
A human potential, human capital. We're giving rural learners in a variety of platforms the ability to realize their full potential, to not be captured by their circumstances, because in South Africa, we've got where you are born determines really what you can achieve in South Africa because of our polarization of resources. So we're working to give those learners, those youth, the ability to realize their potential and then to go get it in a nutshell. Yeah.
Excellent, Felix. And you posted quite a powerful video the other day on LinkedIn where you were walking around the classroom talking about the actual needs on the ground. Can you maybe explain what those needs actually are for people that come from the suburbs and whose kids go to a normal school where everything's working?
So the context is really something that's supreme. And schools that are located in rural areas have been built by the state due to their mandate. But the infrastructure maintenance and the delivery of various programs is what's struggling. And so we've seen that, and that you cannot learn or do a program like coding and robotics in a classroom that doesn't have a ceiling, that doesn't have glass in its windows. And so what we focus on is providing that holistic support structure for learners together with the programs that we roll out. So in that specific video was about the infrastructure upgrades we did in maths and science classrooms. In the video, you'll see no ceiling, the floors, the glass, everything is in ruins. And that was a classroom that's being used when we were fortunate enough to be able to do it during the school holidays. And now when those learners go back, where they went back yesterday, they're going to be in a brand new classroom. So that is what we focus on. It's just like any work environment. How can you do good business if your environment is not an enabling environment? And it's the same principle when you get to schooling.
Absolutely, Felix. I often tell people that if you change your environment, you can change your conversations. So now you're busy upgrading a learner's environment to an environment that's more conducive to the learning. When you're doing these types of projects, what are some of like the time frames that you're generally working from, like when you started a school to when you're almost ready to hand it back to the community?
This is the fun, I suppose, of working in the sector with projects, that projects have different timelines. That specific project, we had 6 days, Monday through to Saturday, to get it done. We renoed 7 classrooms. So everyone just pulled in together. Other projects, usually is over a 12-month span. So for example, we just rounded off a project in Prieska where we trained 20 youth that were classified as NEETs, so not in employment, education or training, in a cybersecurity new venture and advanced digital literacy program as well. So they really do differ. And the key to that is just communication to all stakeholders, and that stakeholder management is important. So it varies. But that's the fun part about this for me, is that every project's going to be new. Like, I do not go to my office knowing what the day is going to bring.
Excellent, Felix. And Felix, talking about these projects that you're involved in, I mean, I know from my experience in working on similar projects for like a Mandela Day initiative or an NPO give back from a corporate, oftentimes you go in, you save the day, But then you go back at the following year or 6 months later and things have almost returned back to where they were or sometimes even worse. How do you prevent that the initiatives that you're doing and the implementation work that you're doing is sustainable, but also almost like protected?
Mm. So that model that you just described was big in corporate South Africa, and we loosely term it the show and go model. You rock up, you have a sports day, you paint the walls, whatever, you take the photo and then you leave. And the problem with that is that there's no value transaction in the sense that the beneficiary or the service user didn't give anything in return for that. They only received. And inherently, there's no value attached to whatever was given, whether it be walls, soccer balls, whatever the case might be. And so we work on a value exchange where the receivers or the beneficiaries are part of the process. So they've got skin in the game, whether it be time, resources, whatever those resources might be, or their talent, meaning that they're helping clean the classrooms, painting, and so forth. And as soon as there's skin in the game, they value it. And then they start looking after it. But the one thing that I can honestly say is a key factor to success is trust, that they must trust that you will come back and help when the time is right. Because that model of show and go is poverty alleviation, whether it be resource poverty, nutritional poverty, financial, but it's a temporary crutch. And COVID showed us that people start looking after themselves when times are tough, and then that crutch is pulled out and it's gone. And then the community falls back down and you see that revert back to the normal state, which is the state of comfort. Even if that state is, let's say, not healthy, not functional, but that is the known state. And that's what people are comfortable in, because keeping something functional, keeping a classroom neat and tidy, takes work and effort. And so if that value hasn't been given to get yourself to the next state, we don't see that happen. And so our projects are not show and go. We usually only work on projects for about 3 years is how we look to walk a path. And the methodology is, year one, we walk in front. Year two, we walk next to. Year three, we walk behind. And then they move on and we find someone else to go walk with, because there's such a big need in South Africa. We can't keep becoming a crutch for a community or service user. So time is a big factor and a value exchange.
Mm. No, I think that's a wonderful example. I mean, you don't want to start a project and then babysit them throughout everything. You want them to take that ownership. You want them to take pride in the infrastructure that they've got and see the impact that it's making in their community. And is this similar to what you've told me before about service over spectacle? I mean, it's easy to make a big spectacle. It's easy to get involved in Mandela Day. But I mean, that can have such a negative impact, because it's a pat on the back, you get your badge, you do your social media post. But I mean, that's honestly not sustainable. I mean, should we actually be doing away with those type of things?
Yes, that's my honest opinion. We should. A show and go is not healthy. It creates entitlement to say, because I'm poor, you need to give me. And so we need to go away from that. Yes, building a relationship with a community or service user become sticky, because you work with humans, you get WhatsApps later at night, you get people asking for extra this, that, or the other. So yes, build the trust, yes, build the relationship, but have clear boundaries to say, this is what we do. Anything else, we will hear you out, we will see if we can, but we are not going to commit to that. So service over spectacle is important. Unfortunately, and we can go down a rabbit hole in a different podcast, but The NPO environment and the funding environment in South Africa is so competitive that nonprofits will engage what's termed as impact washing, where they create these vanity metrics, these large numbers to try to gain attention. And then they focus on the spectacle and not the service. And interestingly enough, corporates are also doing it. Corporates are also inflating their metrics so that they can be seen as such a big community partner, where in reality, that impact was, they might have said, we feed 1,000 school children, but that meal was a juice box, a pack of chips and a lollipop. Now, that's not nutritional support. And so it's the way of framing it. So it needs to be long-term. It needs to be trust-based. And then everybody is going to start building. And to finish that off, we focus on wealth creation, not poverty alleviation. And it can be wealth of the mind, wealth of skills, but that's what we focus on. Yeah.
No, that's absolutely amazing. And I think that that's a refreshing take that I think more corporates need to know about. And I mean, when just talking about corporates, what's some of the most common mistakes you see when corporates or donors make when engaging with these communities? I mean, I often really believe that corporates think these communities are stupid or uneducated, so they're not going to know the difference. So we can just throw wishy-washy stuff at them. We can throw inferior quality. Like you said, just throw sweets at the kids and we say, look, we fed people. I mean, that's just not good enough.
So I think a big mistake that corporates have is that they assume they know what the community wants. They assume because this community is poor, they need X. And so they need to start engaging either through a nonprofit or directly and ask, just what do you need? Where do you need help? Do you need advocacy with the municipality? Because basic infrastructure and water is municipal agenda and what they need to do. And we can go help with that. That can be influential. Or do you need this? Do you need that? So I think corporates need to engage with their communities openly, but also state that we want to hear what you need. And within our means, we can then craft and create a program to help over time with that. But just going into a community and just assuming because you're poor, because you're rural, that this is what you need. And often, yes, those things are needed, but they're not sustainable. You're trying to plug a wall, but there's multiple leaks. And what happens is that, yes, communities can become an overburden. There's so much need. And so people just keep asking. But if you create a relationship of good communication and put up those guardrails and boundaries, everyone knows what the playing field is. So assuming you know what a community wants is the one big problem that we often see. And the other thing is that inherently in the donor and NPC or community dynamic, there's a power asymmetry. And so often what happens is donors, because they give the gift of money, they take power. And because they've got this power, then they will email a community or an NPC and say, tomorrow I need this, or we're arriving tomorrow, get yourselves in order. So communication needs to also improve, and the corporate needs to plan ahead to say, cool, these are our dates. This is what we want to see. This is what we want to work towards. Is that a fair ask? And so communication is important, that just because you've got this power of money, it doesn't give you authority over the people from a sense of humanity. And so those are the two big mistakes or challenges that we see from the donor side or from corporate specifically, because corporates engage very differently with communities than a trust or a foundation or a funding NPC.
No, 100%, Felix. I mean, I really appreciate that viewpoint, because you can easily disregard the community and think you're doing the right thing. You're coming in to save the day. You've got the money. You've got the power. You know everything. But you just can miss the boat completely. And then you tick box. And I mean, you can end up in the newspapers for all the wrong reasons. So if a company or a donor or corporate wants to make sure their money truly moves people forward, what are some of the other things that they must maybe consider, or maybe some, get some internal capacity going, or even educate themselves on how to do things better?
So I think the first thing is that you can't help everybody. There's too much need. Someone that wants to engage with anyone that they want to help, regardless if it's need or upliftment, is to firstly get an awareness of the dynamics and the context. So have an awareness of what do they need, what do they need to do, X, Y, and Z. And then a big thing, and this is often where corporates struggle, is to make a commitment over time to say, for the next 3 years, we will walk this journey with you. Not to commit to a financial obligation, but to commit to the journey. And so if people start knowing this company, they're going to keep on coming back, whether it's just to listen, whether it's just to be part of a celebration event, their presence will be there. And so they start feeling the pulse of the community more. And a massive thing that a lot of corporates are doing right is staff volunteerism, where staff can be starting to be part of the community. So there are five T's that you can work around. And the first three is time, talent, and treasure. Now, staff can give their talents. So if you're working as an accounting firm, there are lots of SMMEs and you've got lots of accountants. Let them do basic business principles with those small SMMEs. This could be WhatsApp relationships. It can be Zoom. It can be very scheduled and structured or informal. But let your staff give their talent and their time as a means of contributing, because then you get the community trusting that corporate and that donor. And the other two, just for the whole picture, is testimony and ties, where the corporate brings their service providers in maybe to fix the school, or brings their other corporate partners in to this community, and the community welcomes it because there's a trust relationship. So I think biggest thing corporates need to look at over time, and not just a tick box exercise for the annual report with everyone standing dressed in brand new t-shirts and caps, and the next day those things go to the back of the cupboard. So committing to time is important. And that's all, not the financial resources, not delivery, but just saying, we will walk this path with you, high or hell water.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great example there. I think the time is something that I've told NPOs myself, is that everyone's got something to give. If you don't have money to give, you've maybe got time to help them unpack some of their pain points, work on their website, help them with their social media, help them with a funding report or something like that. And a lot of that is almost like where you there's a transfer of skills, there's a transfer of knowledge almost from the corporate private sector to help the charity or the organization almost function more like a business. Let's just upgrade how we do things around here. And that can have a lasting impact. And it's not just about money, it's about the time as well. And I mean, I'm a big fan of that. I think everyone's got something that they can give. And then in terms of the money side of things, if you can just help them manage the money a bit better. So instead of saying, look, we need more revenue. So like, guys, where's the money actually going? Are we spending money wisely? Are we getting three quotes? Are we checking? Are there any leaks in the system somewhere? Are we spending money on subscriptions we don't need, on buildings we're no longer utilizing? Do you find that quite often these NPOs, NPCs are shooting themselves in the foot about how they're managing their own finances?
Yes. Yes, because a lot of the founders of nonprofits would be so passionate about solving that problem, and by hook or by crook or by however, they were able to get their NPC off the ground and able to start securing funding. But they remain very passionate, and a lot of nonprofits have got very good business-minded people in that NPC making it work and ticking over if they've been able to secure funding. But the problem is they start being torn in that typical thing of working in your business and on your business. And it's a very tough time for a nonprofit to navigate, because operationally they need to make sure everything is running smoothly because they're held accountable to the reporting. But at the same time, they need to manage their donors. They need to manage their stakeholders. They need to manage their service providers. So a big help that corporates can do when donating is they can also donate their resources to say, listen, we've got social media. We're going to give one post a week to you that you guys can help, or we've got extra accounting interns, let them help you with your books. Because being audited or having independent financial reviews, there's a difference in the way that's perceived, is that an independent financial review can be done by an accountant that's very friendly and they can brush off some things. But if you're audited, it adds a depth of certainty from your donor. And so if corporates can allow for that, and a big thing that NPCs are always going to ask for is operational expenses. So to say, help us operationally so that, yes, R1 doesn't go fully into your service user, but it helps us get the meal to the service user. So the way that I look at that is to say, if you want to do a nutritional support, if you want to buy the food, that's sure. But what are we serving the food on? We need plates. What are we washing the dishes with? We need dishwashing liquid. So in order to put that plate of food, there's so much other things. And I think if corporates are open to that, to understand that process, that's going to help your nonprofit so much more in their delivery of that service to the community. And so, like you say, time, talent, treasure, ties, testimony. Those are the five T's that a corporate can donate and give to the NPC to help them to get to the end user. So I think that's a very important part that corporates can come towards, and to have that mindset, but building trust And the last thing I'd like to mention is something that goes a really long way that corporates can do is capacitating funding. So say now, for example, you're sending your team to do a specific skill set. Invite your NPCs with. Let your staff build relationship, but then they get those skill sets as well. So whether it be social media, health and safety training, if you've got a school, for example, let your corporate also be upskilled to attend that, because they can then give a better service, not only to the community, but also to the donor or the corporate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that last one. That's really, really cool. And the thing is, that is where you can make a consistent impact as well. And it's not just handouts. It's a real impact. You're upskilling people. You're giving them some skills. And you're having that connection again with the NPC. And I think that's where the relationship gets built over time as well. And now, Felix, like working in rural South Africa, what has that taught you about the resilience and the dignity that corporate spaces often miss?
Sure. So building on the previous point is, we focus on giving hand-ups, not handouts. And in order to give a hand-up, you need two hands and there needs to be a pull. And so I think corporates often miss, and donors miss, the context of a reality of a community. That if there is, for example, a power break, there's 300 kilometers of possible electricity lines that could have gone down. And it takes 2 days for the municipality to drive there to see where the fault is, for example. So I think a very big important thing is, if corporates want to get involved in a community, and also for the corporate to understand and make sense of the proposal that your NPC puts forward, go to the community on your own with a staff member from the community. I don't care how you get there, but immerse yourself into that community. Just drive around, see what's on the street corner, see if the kids are playing in the park, drive past the school. If there's an ECD that the proposal is looking at, go to that and just say, hi, listen, we're just popped in. We just want to see how are you doing. If you've ever been to a rural town in South Africa, people are super friendly. They are so happy to engage with people and just talk about their stories. They will share their problems. They'll share what they're excited about. They know that you're not from the town, but they're so open to it, because they also know and cherish, people, because then they know it's an economic stimulus. There's tourism. They're going to spend some money. And so just go be part of that community. Just feel them. See what they're about. Go sit at the local coffee shop. Listen to the people talking. Understand what are some of the problems are. Your waiters, your petrol attendants, the teller at the retail market. Just ask them, so what's happening in town? What's news? And they're going to tell you quickly. Pick up the local gazette or the local newspaper. That's the way that the corporate can really make sense of the community, and therefore the NPC that they want to help or support, they can see, like, is this aligned? Has this NPC got a real understanding of the problem that they're trying to solve?
Mm-hmm. No, I love that example. I think the more you educate yourself, the more you immerse yourself in that environment, I think you're going to build up empathy for what is actually happening on the ground. And you're going to get better informed about how your money and your time and all the other T's are going to make an impact. And I think the better informed you are, then the better decisions you can have. That when you report back to corporate head office and say, look, we spent 5 million rand on this, you can actually demonstrate the impact. We visited them, we identified this, we thought we were going to spend money on this, but the community has actually told us they actually need this. Then you can redirect funds, you can make a better impact. Because oftentimes we like you said, we assume we know what the community needs. But we're looking at it from like a bird's eye view, we've disconnected. But on the ground, you're going to completely see different needs and you're going to have different conversations there. I think that's wonderful advice there, Felix. Now, switching gears a little bit, you also do work with family trusts and more family offices on the philanthropic side. Why do you think there's this big disconnect between South Africa's philanthropic side and nonprofit sector? And there's almost like lack of trust. And I mean, I always told people, South Africa's not a poor country. We just have poor leadership. Does this also filter down into how we're running our NPOs and why like philanthropy doesn't go as far as it actually should be going?
So this is a big question, John. And it's something very close to my heart. And I fully agree with you. There's plenty of cash in South Africa to help solve our problems. I think there's a couple of things. So I think that leadership within nonprofits and working in nonprofits is not sexy. And so really good leaders, really good, ambitious young people don't want to go work for it because they want that soft, cushy life that the banking industry can give you. They want to wear the pointy shoes and go sit in the office. And so we need better leaders in the nonprofit sector that are willing to take up the leadership challenge and really lead that nonprofit because they're a social enterprise. I think the other big problem we see is that nonprofits are often run at a very grassroots level. And I personally dislike the word charity because, like a soup kitchen, it's an old gogo that's feeding 20 kids. But if she doesn't get the next donation, it stops. And that's a typical charity because they're not focusing on the business and how to make this business sustainable. I was once looked at with a something. I don't really know what the word was, but I said in an academic scenario, just because I run a nonprofit doesn't mean my business is not profitable. The only difference is I don't pay dividends. And so running a nonprofit, you still need to ensure that you run a revenue that's positive so that you can save it for a rainy day. And that's very important because unfortunately, a lot of nonprofits are burning their cash to the last rand, and then they're in need of emergency funding. So I think the leadership and the financial management of nonprofits is very important. One of your previous guests, Andrew from Finance Fusion, said it fantastic. He said, annual financial statement is a rearview mirror look, and you need to look ahead. And I think a lot of nonprofits are not doing that because they're so focused on operationally on their service users. They're not looking at their accounting. They just look at the bank balance. If the account says we've got money, then they keep rolling. But once it gets less, they're like, we need to start fundraising. So financial management is something I think is super important. And again, that's where your donors can assist. Because also at the same breath, we've had a lot of financial mismanagement, a lot of fraud, a lot of corruption within the nonprofit sector. It's a fact. A lot of money just disappears. There's this ongoing conversation of terrorism and money laundering coming in through nonprofits. And unfortunately, they have been a vehicle for this type of behavior. And so the distrust is that's where it's often rooted in because that money is now just lost. And so for me, I think if you can prove financial management of funds that are not yours, and I think that's a big problem nonprofits also don't understand, is that just because you've secured a 5 rand donation, that money is not meant for you. It's meant for the service user, for the beneficiary. You're the custodian of that money. Yes, you need to keep your platform afloat, but it needs to go to the end user. And I think that often that mindset is different. And so I think that's where a lot of mistrust comes. And that's why my practice is in trust-based philanthropy. So before we talk about money, let's first trust each other. Let's first see if we're lack of people before we start talking money. Because I was once said, money makes people funny. It's that simple.
No, very good point there, Felix. And talking about building this trust, let's say you and I meet. How are we going to establish this trust? How are we going to check each other out and see, can we actually put this project together or get this infrastructure off the ground? What are some of those key steps that you take in your consulting work to build that trust or to at least to show the philanthropist, hey, man, I know what's going on. We're going to walk this journey with you. How does that actually work?
I think you need to be very aware of who you're talking to. It's a human. They worked hard for that money. And so they're emotionally connected to it. So you need to, as an NPC, or as a fundraiser, or as a philanthropic consultant like myself, really engage in a very authentic manner with the human, not with the money. You need to connect with the human. We say people give money to friends, not strangers. And so really the first step in fundraising is friend raising. So you need to become friends with these people. And if they don't want to be friends with you, you need to say, cool, and walk away. So make sure that there's alignment between you and the donor or the people that you want to work with. And this often results in nonprofit mission drift, where they will align themselves with someone artificially purely to get to the money. And donors they can smell that from a mile away. And they will ask you the difficult questions, and then you're going to be stuck in the mud on that one. So the best advice I can give is connect with the human. connect with the human, ask them about them, their family, tell them about yourselves as well. Because often fundraisers are guilty of that they will craft a persona that's externally facing, but they won't reveal or give any within reason personal details, like you're married, you've got kids, you like making sushi on the weekend, whatever it might be. And they need to really become vulnerable, because in that vulnerability, the trust is going to form. But if you keep it transactional, it feels like you're buying something from a retailer. Here's the R5, give me my output. And we want to get impact, not outputs. And there's a journey to get an impact. Impact doesn't happen. It's not a just add water recipe.
No, 100%, Felix. I really appreciate what you're saying, and also the tone that you're saying it in, because I think too often these things just get left unsaid. And then things start off well. There's a honeymoon period. Everything's hunky-dory, but it quickly goes off the rails because there isn't this relationship. There isn't enough trust. We haven't shown each other enough of actually what's going on behind the scenes. You've also said that philanthropy should move from charity to sustainable wealth creation. So not poverty alleviation, but wealth creation. How does that impact in terms of the projects that we should be choosing to fund and maybe our involvement?
John, this is a difficult one, because inherently in South Africa, the mindset is that a nonprofit is not self-sustaining, that it needs to be fueled by someone else. And so a challenge within the sector, the third sector, is that you need to build a nonprofit or entity that can sustain itself by creating service users. So there are great examples of that. And I won't name any names, but there are really good examples of how NPCs create a social enterprise. And unfortunately, in South Africa, we've got the handout mentality. Like, because NPCs are very wise, they know corporate South Africa has to donate 1%. They are very much aware of the BEE scorecard and these SED spends. So they do know that the corporates need to donate. And so that's why all these guardrails have come in place. And so it's important to have that trust and build that trust with your donor and the people that you're looking to get to, so that you can have an entity that you can prove the concept. And that if given the seed funding or the startup or the proof of concept funding, whatever you want to term it as, it can start running on its own. And then to hand it over to someone. So our model, for example, is, and our coding and robotics model is, we help start Extramural coding and robotics. We have all the assets purchased X, Y, and Z. But after 3 years, there is an obligation for the Department of Education and the school to pick that up. But in doing that, we consult with the SGB and tell them 2 years, this is coming. You need to budget for it. You need to understand what's coming. We have meetings with the DOE. This is what's coming. Are you prepared to sign it into your asset register? So you can't just throw this hot potato into a community's lap. You've got to help them get used to this responsibility, because they don't have this responsibility. And a big lesson for me that I've learned is, if you hand something over like this, often we see it as an asset. The community sees it as a liability, because they've got something that the other schools don't. And jealousy is what's going to ruin that, because other schools and people are going to want to try to take it. So building a self-sustaining model, or building these packages that become self-sustaining because you hand them over to someone else, is key. If you're going to follow the soup kitchen model, you're doing good work, and I take nothing away from it, but it's not self-sustaining. And you're less likely to get repeat donations or to scale that to all those that need it. So very difficult. And I think a lot of people struggle with that dynamic from a business point of view.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%, Felix. And talking about technology, how do you see technology and digital learning changing the landscape of rural education in the next decade? I mean, a lot of these kids are just lucky to have a piece of paper and a pen or pencil to write with. Now you're introducing technology there. How's it actually going to work?
So something that keeps on surprising me, John, is that smartphone penetration into rural communities is super high. The problem is the cost of data and the reliability of that data. So most of our service users have got smartphones, or at least access in the household to a smartphone. So they're very competent at using a smartphone. But the problem is that smartphone is connected from a brain perspective to entertainment. And let's use the word distraction. So once we ask our learners to do research on, say now, for example, in the coding and robotics, we want them to look up some Python code. They are not willing to exchange the data they've got for that research because the data is earmarked for entertainment. So a big thing with technology and introducing technology is not necessarily the technology, but it's the purpose of the technology. And understanding a cell phone can be used for multiple services or outputs, not just selfie and TikTok videos. And so that becomes a very interesting dynamic. Same with providing free Wi-Fi. For me, fundamentally, the difference between a rural child and a child living in an urban township is their ability to access free resources such as free Wi-Fi. So a child living in the township can probably find two or three places where there's free Wi-Fi, and they can then access that. Rural, you don't have the same type of availability of free Wi-Fi because fiber has not landed yet. So the cost of data is still very much connected to a cell phone tower. And so free Wi-Fi, uncapped, unthrottled, is not there yet. And hopefully in the next year or two, we can say that it's arrived. And so technology is there. It's the cost of connecting to the internet. And like I said, there are a couple of companies that are giving great access to the internet in very urban areas, but not necessarily in the rural areas because, yes, the scale of the market doesn't warrant it yet. But I believe that time will come. So technology adoption is there. It's just about accessing the internet to use it in a productive manner, because having a laptop these days is not good enough. You need to have internet connectivity to have your licenses, connectivity for browsing internet. Having a PC is not good enough. It needs to be connected to the internet. And internet connection is where the pain point lies.
Mm. No, thank you. Thank you for actually describing that in good detail there. And I mean, the name that comes to mind immediately is someone like Alan Knott Craig Jr., who I've met and is doing amazing work with FiberTime. But I mean, you're right. That is more in the urban areas where there's a big catchment of people, where it's obviously the economies of scale are working in their favor. But I mean, hopefully that same concept can be rolled out to the Northern Cape, areas like the Free State as well. Felix, I just want to pivot to our second part of the podcast here, where we focus on your right place, which we believe is at the intersection of your roles, relationships, and environments. You founded Siafunda in 2018. When did you know that this was like kind of part of your right place and not just another project, but like almost like your calling?
So my history at the time of, in the previous year, 2017, I was a maths and science teacher at a well-resourced school. And simply, I got tired of teaching photosynthesis five times a week. I knew it was very draining for me. I came home and I wasn't a pleasant person. I loved the interaction with my learners, but that didn't work for me. And so I always make this joke. I broke up with teaching and I said, it's not you, it's me. But I stayed in education. And when I founded Siafunda, initially, the first 1,000 rand that I got to start to register the company and so forth came from my mother. And I knew it was the right place, but Siafunda couldn't carry a salary for me. I couldn't make this my permanent job because I still needed to contribute to my own financial health and wealth and also to my household. And so I only started working permanently for Siafunda last year, September, when Siafunda had enough depth that the board could offer me permanent employment. So the right place for me was in 2019. I had moved to Upington with my wife, who was placed there for her community service year. And I had a conversation with local players in education. And someone said, but we want to do coding and robotics. We want this to come to Upington, to the Northern Cape, but we don't know who to call. But at that exact point, I knew who to call. And so all of a sudden, this network of just knowing people allowed me to bring a project to Upington. I was at the right place at the right time, and I got the funding to do a pilot project for 12 months. And we just made it work. We bootlegged it, and we obviously ran at a loss, but we made it work. And here I am today servicing 36 schools in the Northern Cape just with coding and robotics. And so it takes a lot of grit and determination, but because I was in the right place, didn't feel like work to me. I loved driving 203 kilometers to get to my first school. That for me was the right place to be. So I knew it when I found it, and I enabled myself with other aspects like a day job, like building a network, so that eventually I was able to migrate to it and make this my day job.
Mm. No, absolutely amazing, Felix. And I mean, in the harsh beauty of the Northern Cape, I mean, you've racked up thousands of kilometers driving between communities and the projects. Tell me about that time and space for you. I mean, sometimes you might be sitting in the car all by yourself. What is going through your mind at that time? Are you using it to listen to podcasts? Are you spacing out? Like what does that time alone on those long straight roads in the middle of nowhere do for you as a human being?
So, you know, if you don't download the podcast, there's no cell phone reception, so you can't stream it. You've got to download it. If you forget that, you've got a problem. So mostly I am, let's use the word, in my own mind, in my own space. I am thinking about what's happened, what's happening. It's my thinking time. And I use the terminology often when I get back from big trips or when I've engaged, I'm peopled out. Like I don't want anything to do with anyone. I want to sit in my own house in silence. I might talk to my wife, but I often tell her, like, just give me 10 minutes. But I'm in my own head because it's so busy. There's such an overstimulation when you're in communities and when you're working and everyone's trying to engage with you, that is really some time to just make sense of my current landscape and context. So that for me is where a lot of these things come from, like how I am going to engage or what I want to do with this, that. So it's thinking time. And I think a lot of people would want craving that type of luxury of sitting for 2.5 hours. Your phone cannot ring. You cannot get a WhatsApp because there's no cell phone signal. All you can do is hold the steering wheel in a straight line for 170 kilometers and you can just think. The only thing is you need to watch your right-hand foot because sometimes it gets a bit heavy and you start hitting 150, 160 Ks and you got to bring it down to 120. But that, I'm in my own mind. I'm just thinking about everything.
No, amazing, Felix. I love those long straight roads in the Northern Cape, especially going if you're on your way to Namibia. It gives you a lot of time, a lot of space, and just to collect your thoughts. I think here in the suburbs and in the comfort of the cities, we just don't have that space anymore. So I mean, I'm glad it gives you the environment. Allows you to have the space to think. But also, I mean, I'm thinking now about you in these rural communities and you down in the dirt with these people sometimes and on the projects and everything. But then you also wear another hat where you have to be in the corporate boardrooms and you have to maintain these relationships with people that can literally determine the future of education in South Africa. Tell me about working in those two. I mean, they're completely contrasting, so far apart. How do you maintain your own authenticity? Because you're almost like the middleman. You're like the agent connecting the money to the projects, connecting the opportunities with each other. Tell me about how you maintain that authenticity and relationships in that.
Yeah, another word that I would use is a broker. And John, it's difficult. It's something I'm going to say the word challenge myself with and struggle because going to a Sandton boardroom or a CBD in Cape Town boardroom is a very different experience to entering the principal's office at a rural school in Lupeng. And I struggle with that polarization of resources. It's difficult to go to Johannesburg, meet in Sandton, and then fly to Upington or Shishen and then have to literally change your shoes because it's just red dirt everywhere because of the iron oxide. So it is an ongoing challenge, and it's the biggest challenge often is relaying these differences to your donors. So to say, one of our biggest expenses is fuel because of travel. And so to tell someone in a corporate boardroom, the CFO, why we've got a budget above norms and standards for fuel is difficult because they don't have that understanding. Why we have to have a certain type of tire because of the dirt roads. Why we only use Buckies and not Ford or not Vivos, for example, because the roads are not conducive because of the trucks and the tar road is so uneven. And so it's something I honestly struggle with is relaying that. And we spoke about it offline is immersing people into the situations and really getting them to understand and see. So when we've got an event, we invite our donors to come to the event and to be part of it, and not to put the spotlight on them to really make a big rah-rah, but to just sit in the crowd and understand the gratefulness and opportunity of just having finger platters for lunch or having bottled water. Bottled water is a currency in the Northern Cape, because tap water is not necessarily very safe, but bottled water, if you get a bottle water from someone, it's a massive sign of respect, because they value that water so much. And so that in the boardroom in corporate South Africa is nonchalant. Having cool, chilled water is something. And so it's something I challenge with. It's something I tend to become very radical in my thinking with, type of like a Robin Hood mentality, to really get the resources. But luckily, I'm grounded by a couple of good mentors that say, no, you can't go take all that money and give it. You have to go about it the right way. So it is challenging being in these polarizing environments, seeing a complete desperation and lack of versus a total abundance in the Sandtons and city of Cape Town.
Absolutely amazing, Felix. I think it must be quite eye opening to be a fly on the wall in these conversations that you're having, from the cushy boardroom all the way to the dust bowl of the Northern Cape. And I mean, just listening to you here, I feel like you've been called to do this. It's such a unique role that you're fulfilling, because not everybody wants to leave Sandton. They don't want that. They're used to driving 10 km between work and the office. You're driving 110 km minimum between different sites, and maybe a couple of 100 km in a day just to get stuff done on the project sites and meet with community leaders and things like that. So no, I definitely applaud you for this. Felix, like me, you're a member of the LACA network here in Cape Town. Tell me about your journey so far and why you joined originally.
John, as I mentioned, I started with Siyafunda permanently last year, September 2024. And around the start of 2025, I started experiencing loneliness in my office, because I work from home, I work alone. All our people that support us are all over the country. And I actually heard about Rainier speaking about the LACA network on another podcast of a mentor of mine. And I started following the journey and so forth. Because I felt so isolated and alone, the LACA network became a place for me to engage with people with no expectation of anything besides a connection. It gave me the ability to connect to people all across the globe simply to ask a question. From an authentic human, I did it. I asked two people in Mauritius, what is the lifestyle in Mauritius? I've connected with people in the UK, in the US, getting mindsets about the nonprofit or the third sector work. And beyond that, the actual events as well, from paddle or upskilling events, has been so meaningful for me as an individual. And I've been able to apply that in my work as a philanthropic consultant or in the third sector in Siyafunda. So for me, it helped me connect with people without any obligation or onus of an exchange of anything. People just want to talk. And I just want to talk to them. And I've learned so much just having conversations. We spoke to a gentleman in Canada, and he gave me such great insight regarding, he said, basically, no one's going to come looking for you. You've got to go find people. And I was like, mind blown, so obvious. And so for me, the LACA network has been a place of connection, welcoming, warming, and just open, authentic communication. What was really easy for me is that it very much gave me the guidelines of how to connect, when to connect, what to do, and all the guide rails. And I really appreciated that structure, because often these things can get so out of control and then we don't enjoy ourselves. So I really enjoy the LACA network. I'll definitely stay a member, and I'm a full-on supporter for especially nonprofits engaging it, because you learn so much that you're able to take back. It's not about soliciting a donation. It's about wealth creation, as we've said. Create wealth for yourself.
No, absolutely amazing, Felix. I really like the encouragement there to other NPOs. We've got a couple of other NPO members in the LACA network, and it's all about starting conversations. And I mean, it's also about upgrading the level of conversations that you're having. And there's nothing wrong with an NPO talking to another business owner, because you're going to get insights into how to run your NPO. Run it like a business. Upgrade your systems, upgrade your reporting, maybe bring in a board, maybe bring in an audit committee, something like that. That's going to contribute to your NPO functioning better. And I often say this, I mean, South Africa doesn't need more NPOs. We just need better run NPOs. There is enough. There's hundreds of thousands of NPOs. We just need better run NPOs, a better governance, and we're going to turn this country around one by one.
100% agree with that. We've got just under 300,000 registered nonprofits. We don't need more nonprofits.
Wrapping up the podcast, Felix, and I mean, maybe you've alluded to this already, but where would you say is your right place in 2025?
We've said it before, on the long, straight, narrow roads of the Northern Cape. Because when I'm on that road, I'm traveling with purpose, I'm traveling with resolve, and I know that any engagement that I have will mean something to someone, and I include myself in that. So that is my right place. Once that red sand gets into your blood, you can't get it out. And the beauty of the Northern Cape, that sunset, that sunrise, is just where my heart is. My family is from the Northern Cape. And it's just a deep connection to that province and the potential that lies in that province. So my right place is the Northern Cape. It's a truly magical place that once experienced, that's why people keep going back. It's just awesome roerwind, in Afrikaans. Yeah.
I love that word, and congratulations, Felix. That's a really special place to call your right place. Felix, we could go on for so much longer. There's a couple of different angles we haven't even explored about this. If people want to connect with you, learn more about the work that you do, connect with Siyafundo, even travel with you to the Northern Cape, where's the best place to get a hold of you?
It's LinkedIn, probably is the easiest. Just Felix Spies on LinkedIn, and Spies in English, if you spell it S-P-I-E-S. Otherwise, Felix at siyafunda.ef.org.za, and Google is really easy. And yeah, if anyone wants to travel with or come just be part or witness and be an observer, they're more than welcome to. And although we do a lot of work in the Northern Cape, we like working in rural South Africa. So we've explored Limpopo, KZN, Eastern Cape. And so any rural place is something, and a place where we will be. We're on our way to Northwest soon to start working in that province as well. But I would really encourage people to do it. We've got double cab buckies, and we really have backseat drivers. And so we'd love some extra passengers to just come along and just see and witness and be part of it. It's life-changing, and it's why I'll never go back to anything else. I'll keep on fighting for this. For my right place.
Awesome, Felix. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Felix Spies. Please connect with him. As he mentioned above, we'll put all the links down below. Thank you so much to everyone for listening, for your support. Please like, comment, and subscribe on the video. And please also share this video with your friends and family as well. And we will see you again next time at the right place. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, John.